Are your school days out of sight when you took English, art, and math? What's your favorite Fahrenheit? How sour are the grapes of wrath? Do you need a challenger or disgusting Salinger? Do you love the written word? What happened to the mockingbird? Our show is just beginning, so find a place to sit. These questions will be on the test. It's time for Sophomore Lit.
Welcome back to Sophomore Lit, where we reread your high school reading list. I'm your host, John McCoy, and with me this week is Anaïs Concepcion.
Hi, excited to be here.
Anaïs and I met online, Anaïs, why don't you tell people out there about your podcast and where people can find you?
Sure. So I'm part of a micro network of three shows. The network is called Literary Roadhouse. And our shows, two of them are discussions of either short stories or full length novels. And the third one is for writers who are writing short stories to talk about that experience. So you can check us out at literaryroadhouse.com.
This time we are doing Antoine de Saint-Exupéry's The Little Prince, which is a classic of world's literature for children, or perhaps maybe adult's book masquerading as a children's book. We discussed a lot of different books back and forth. Anaïs, you do a lot of contemporary fiction on your podcast. Is that correct?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
And I thought that this might be a good book for us to see if we could find some interesting themes on, because it's a... As anyone who's read the book knows, a highly poetic book and a very influential book of French modernism. My background with this book is a little complicated. I read this as a child. I remember finding the paperback on my parents' bookshelf, where I found lots of books that I probably shouldn't have found. But this was a book that I could read. It confused me very much. I thought it was very beautiful. But as a book for a child, I found the ending a little bit scary and a little bit difficult to understand. And then many years later, I had read it a few times. When I was in high school, this book was assigned to me as a book to practice my French in. So this was a high school French book. And the experience of reading the book in French is quite remarkable, because you start to understand all the crazy little idioms that this book is peppered with, and the strange halting speech patterns that seem a little odd rendered into English make perfect sense in French.
It was interesting for me because I've actually never read this book. So obviously it's been on my radar in the sense that it's in pop culture. I knew, okay, he comes from another planet, it's an asteroid, there's a rose, but I didn't know any of the lessons. You know, I just sort of knew the kind of like very, very bird's eye view. I expected the fox, but I didn't know what the fox would say. So it was surprising for me to read it now as an adult, having never even read it as a child. And I even wonder if I would have gotten it or enjoyed it as a child, looking back, knowing how I was then. But I definitely enjoyed it as an adult.
This book is by French author Antoine de Saint-Exupéry, who was born of nobility. He was like a son of a countess, I believe. Mm-hmm. Anaïs, you did a lot of research on this, didn't you?
I don't want to say a lot and then trip up, but yeah, I did quite a bit of research because I think the thing that fascinated me the most was I was wondering, like, is he a children's book author? Like, I had no idea about the author, anything. So I kind of came into it completely green. And then when I saw, no, not really, that this was a big departure from his other works, and it was his last work, and it was before the year he died, then I just had to keep digging.
Antoine de Saint-Exupéry was not a children's author for most of his life. Mm-hmm. In fact, for most of his life, he was an aviator, an early aviator in the years between the... First World War and the Second World War. He did a lot of flights from France into Africa and on into Asia. And he actually did, at one point in the 30s, he had a crash in the desert of Northern Africa. Mm-hmm. And that obviously features prominently in this story. In real life, he crashed with a co-pilot, and the two of them barely survived after several days stranded in the desert. In the book, it's just the narrator. So what did you find fascinating about his background?
So I read the thing where he crashed in the Sahara and he was attempting to break the Paris to Saigon speed record. There seemed to be something very kind of masculine and, I guess, animated about his life. He seemed to always be going for sort of the next thing. In a way, he kind of, I kept thinking a little bit of Hemingway because of the hyper masculine, kind of story, life that he had and the bouts of depression that he had as well. The way that he differed from Hemingway, I guess, would be when it came to women. It seemed that he had that one love, Consuelo, who everyone believes to be the rose in this story. Which, well, not everyone, I should say people who like study this. So I guess those parallels sort of intrigued me, but then the way that he writes is very different. There's something, you said that the translation in English was very halting, but I found it to be, in a way, it made me feel like it was very French, even though it was written in English, which I enjoyed a lot as well.
Just as a note, we read the Catherine Wood translation, which was the only translation available in America for a long time. I know that some people, some critics have seen that as having some inaccuracies, but having read it in both English and French, I think Catherine Wood really captures the feeling of the original quite well. My French would have to be better to confirm or to deny whether or not it was inaccurate in any way.
So the traditional translation was Catherine Wood's. The new translation is by Richard Howard, and it's not impossible, but it's very difficult to get your hands on the Catherine Wood's translation these days outside of, I guess you could say, like an antique bookstore. And in the comment section on Amazon, there were these massive, massive essays by people who are scholars of The Little Prince or who are just very passionate about it, where they went line by line comparing the translations. And it's really interesting because I think this harkens back to what I was saying about the Catherine Wood's translation being a little bit more French, in the sense that one of the ones that they compare is the line that the fox says about how it's the time you wasted on the rose that makes the rose special. I'm paraphrasing, but that's roughly the Catherine Wood's translation. And in the Richard Howard one, it's really different. It's something about how it's the time you lost instead of wasted. And that little difference, to me, it seems like the Richard Howard one, it's like more the way that an American would speak, or a Westerner in general, where I feel like the kind of themes of waste, a little bit of the nihilism that happens, the way the Little Prince sort of chooses to end his life at the end, feels a little bit more French to me.
Well, spoiler alert.
Oh, spoiler alert. I didn't know we didn't do spoilers.
No, that's okay. I think most of our audience here is fairly familiar with the book. You did mention that a lot of people believe that the rose is modeled after his wife, Consuelo de Saint-Exupéry, who also had a fascinating life. Was she Argentinian?
Salvadorian.
And she had divorced her first husband, but claimed to be widowed from him because it was easier to get along in those days. And she had married again, and he had died. And then she met de Saint-Exupéry, and they had a very passionate marriage. They were very close, but she had a lot of affairs. Anyway, whether or not one chooses to believe that the rose is modeled after his wife, the rose is the only major female character in this book, and we should probably talk about that as far as how gender plays out in this book when we get to her. Mm-hmm. The circumstances for the creation of this book are also quite interesting. This book was written while de Saint-Exupéry was in exile from Vichy, France. This was after the Nazi occupation of France, and de Saint-Exupéry was a member of the resistance. But at the time he was writing this book, he was actually living in New York City, and then he traveled to the country to I believe Connecticut to write this. Mm-hmm. I may be wrong about that.
Yeah, that's what I read.
And it's fascinating to think of this book that is sort of such a quintessentially French book being written in America. And apparently he wrote it all by hand. And of course, the other fascinating thing about this book is it's full of de Saint-Exupéry's own illustrations.
So he was a lifetime doodler. I'm also a lifetime doodler, but he's more skilled than I am. But apparently he had been doodling the Little Prince without having given him a name or a character for years before he even wrote the manuscript, that he would do the sort of like the baggy, slightly too short pants on the boy with the messy hair and the really long scarf, and that this was something that friends of his had seen before they even knew that he was writing this book. So it seems like the character is a little bit of like an avatar that's been following him along his life, even as an adult. The one thing that I want to talk about is his death a little bit, but if we're going to hold off on spoilers because
let's talk about that when we get to
Because then all of a sudden his story becomes interesting again, the author. That's the part that really got me.
So let's talk about the book. The book starts not in medias res, but with one of these very French introductory digressions where de Saint-Exupéry, or the narrator, we'll call him, because he doesn't name himself, he just uses the first person. The narrator talks about his early experiences drawing and how he attempted to draw what appeared to the grown-ups around him to be a hat, but was in fact a boa constrictor eating an elephant. And this was quite an arresting first page, I remember, when I read it as a child. Partly because it opens with this this delightfully horrific picture of a boa constrictor eating a small animal. I actually know a woman who has this tattooed on her shoulder. it's a great kind of iconic image, and this introduces, I think, Exupéry's one of his main themes of the book, which is that the things that matter in life are the things that can't be seen, and or the things that are obscured by something else. So the idea that when you're a child, you're able more freely to see inside things, and when you're an adult, you can only see the exterior of things. And it's only when he draws, for example, a cross-section of the boa constrictor that the adults see the elephant inside, and then they tell him to take up something other than being an artist.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, which then kind of flows seamlessly into the second great theme, which is what is something that is a matter of consequence? Because even when the adults can see it, even when he reveals for them the elephant, then they still just sort of dismiss it as frivolous and childish. And that comes up again throughout the book several times.
Now, do you find that to be, I mean, I don't want to skip ahead too much to themes or not, but the thing that runs throughout this book is a wistfulness and a sadness on the narrator's part of how alone he feels in the adult world, how he feels that there aren't adults out there who see the world as he does, and he romanticizes childhood as a time when people had insight that they've since lost. As a kid, I love this because as a kid, you love to be told that you are special and that that there's something inherently better about being a child than being an adult. As an adult, I look back on it and I'm a little bit suspect of this. I don't know that as a kid, I think I was a little bit more empirical than I have grown up to be as an adult.
There is like a little bit of like romanticism, like you said, it's a little too sweet. It's got that treacle to it, but it's, if you don't accept it, like if you allow that this adult, the narrator, is able to comprehend this, then you have to allow that other adults do as well. And I think I saw it more as a nudge to other adults to just indulge this side of yourself a little bit more rather than something sort of didactic, like saying this is children. I didn't see it as much as like, well, because kids have this ability, they are somehow wiser. Like, I think that tends to be a trope that you see in a lot of stories that involve children, that children are really wise because they haven't been, I guess, like polluted with the real world or the adult world. And this one, it had that, but it felt a little bit more gentle, like not as heavy-handed to me in my reading of it. Because the prince was pretty serious as well. Like, he's like thinking logistics for like, you know, how he's going to take care of things back home. He meets him and he's asking, like, after he meets the little prince, is like, okay, I need you to draw me a sheep, and then I need a box, and I need a muzzle, and all these things. So there seems to be a blurring in the line between what's matter of consequence, what's whimsy, and both the adult narrator and the little prince are capable of both.
Right. Now, you bring up the introduction of the little prince. That happens immediately in mm-hmm. the second chapter here. In between, the narrator has grown up and become an adult, and he has become an aviator. Mm-hmm. And just as de Saint-Exupéry had his crash in the Sahara, so too our narrator has a crash in the Sahara and finds himself stranded without a radio and with very few provisions. Obviously, in a period of great distress and panic. Now, when I was reading this as an adult, I picked up on something that I never thought of as a child, which is, of course, there is a temptation, I think, from a adult perspective to see the action of this story as some sort of a fever dream brought about by dehydration or something.
Mm-hmm.
And then as I read on, I was glad to see that de Saint-Exupéry did nothing to encourage this reading of the book. I eventually settled on in my adult reading of this book was that being close to death and in fear of his life brought about a certain openness and awareness where he was able to more fully enter into the playful and strange world of the prince appearing and just kind of go with it, because what else are you going to do when you're stranded out in the desert?
Yeah. So I had the same temptation to explain it as like a fever dream or kind of like one of those just before death when you're reviewing your life and you're having your regrets and he's thinking like, oh yeah, when I was a kid, I was so much more wise and whimsical and I lost that. Like kind of like that sort of regret reflection on his life. And then as soon as I had that temptation, I sort of like yelled at myself like, wow, I'm being the adult that this book is criticizing that needs to find that logical answer. And I think as you say now, that your explanation is, okay, so he accepts the prince because as he's late in life, there's nothing better to do. I think even the need to have even that much of an explanation speaks to the criticism that is being made in the book of adults, doesn't it? But we can't resist because I'm doing the same thing. I want that logic as well.
The prince shows up, and as you mentioned, he's this funny little man. He's drawn as a child, but the Exupéry refers to him as a little man. I wonder if that is just a French idiom or not, but he is this elegantly dressed, kind of wearing this, I don't know how you would describe it, sort of a Napoleonic dress robe, mm-hmm. and boots, and with a little saber and little epaulets made of stars. And he immediately asks for a sheep, to be drawn a sheep, and Exupéry tries. He fails a few times because each time the prince finds something wrong with it, until he, in frustration, draws a box and says the sheep is inside. And this is, and the prince immediately says, that's exactly what I wanted. And so the prince is the audience that the narrator has been looking for all his life, the audience who is able to immediately see inside something rather than on the surface of things.
It reminded me of another story. It's like a children's parable. It was told in the oral tradition, I believe, in sort of like ancient Muslim culture. But in that story, there's a king who, his daughter, the princess, she wants the moon, and he can't reason with her that you can't have the moon. Like, she wants to wear the moon so then the advisor says to the king, I'll handle this. He goes to the princess and he asks her, well, what do you think the moon is? And she goes, it's about the size of my thumb and it's made of gold. So then at the next new moon, when there's nothing in the sky, they present to her just a circle of gold for her to wear around her neck, and she was really happy thinking that she had the moon. And then so this thing with the box made me think of that, because it's not about the thing. It's not about the moon or the sheep. It's about giving the child what the child thinks they want, whatever that is, whether it's a piece of gold or whatever he's imagining is inside the box.
We learn that the prince comes from an asteroid. Mm. The asteroid, what's the number? B612.
Yep.
Which is very charming, and there's a lot of apparently throughout the world literature there are lots and world culture there are lots of things named B612 in homage to this book.
In my research of the author as well, when he was airmail pilot, his serial number on his plane was A612, so they think it came from that.
Very good. The prince apparently comes from a planet where one of the things he has to do from day to day is monitor this tiny planet. I mean, we're talking about a planet the size of about a house, we're told, so the prince can walk around it very comfortably in a couple of minutes. And he has to monitor the surface of the planet carefully because every day tiny plants can grow up, little bushes, and if they turn out to be baobab trees, he has to dig them up because we're given the warning that you have to dig out these things when they're small problems before they become big problems. And of course, again, grown-ups being grown-ups, a lot of readers look to this as being an allegory for Nazism. Although, this book, for being written in the middle of World War II, this book really doesn't to me speak much about the war in any concrete ways, other than just sort of having an overall feeling of sort of sadness and wistfulness.
Yeah, I read that thing as well about how the baobabs might be a reference to Nazism, but I'm not convinced, even when I've read the arguments that that's what it could be alluding to. If so, maybe there's something about baobab trees that I don't know, but it seems sort of like a very weak connection, other than he was alive during World War II.
The prince wants to have a sheep to help him destroy these trees when they're young. The sheep will eat them. But then the prince is also concerned because there is a rose on his planet that he does not want to ha be eaten, and he's very concerned that the sheep will eat the rose. And this passage here where he complains, or he expresses his anxiety to the narrator by asking in an indirect way, why do roses have thorns if it won't stop animals from eating them? And the narrator is at this point trying very hard to fix his plane's engine, and he has no patience for this, and he says that he's concerned with matters of consequence. This is where I think this whole phrase of matters of consequence really becomes sort of the major repeating motif of the book.
But I loved his little speech where he's saying, I have it here, where he's saying, the flowers have been growing thorns for millions of years. For millions of years, the sheep have been eating them just the same. And it's not a matter of qu consequence to try to understand why the flowers go to so much trouble to grow thorns, which are never of any use to them. And it just has this sort of simplicity where it's like, as an adult, you get it. You're like, no, the plane is definitely more important right now. But it's still very arresting. It's convincing. So I liked it. I thought it was beautifully done, poetic as well.
There's also another motif that's brought up, which is the motif of sunsets. The prince wants to go see a sunset, and he's told he will have to wait for one, which is very disconcerting for him because on his planet, whenever he wants a sunset, all he does is move his chair forward a bit. And it's a lovely image, but it's also another I image of sadness because he says that you love the sunset when you're so sad. And the narrator says, were you sad the day you watched 44 sunsets? Now, this kind of dialogue is crazily French. If you ever read more 20th century French, I went on from reading this in to the next thing I read was a story by Marguerite Duras, I believe, and that was a much more bleak and somber book, but all the dialogue in it was exactly the same. And I always wonder if you go to France, if people actually do have these kinds of conversations that you associate with new wave cinema, where they're just kind of talking past each other. Maybe that's the case or not. Have you spent any time in
It's
France?
funny. One of my closest friends, she's French, and she goes over there, every every summer, and we laugh about this. Like, we'll, like, you know, watch a French movie or comment on one where it's like they're talking past each other. But I think it's more like almost like an art aesthetic than necessarily the way that real everyday people might speak. To be fair, really, Corsica, which apparently is a true French, but that's where she's from. But I do feel like it's something about the culture that sort of values this as an aesthetic. And I'm sure there's some people who must do it as well if they're sort of mimicking that. But I think that's one of the things that I meant when I said that this felt so French to me. You know, were you sad that day? The prince says nothing. Like, next, like, right. You know, you expect it to cut to them like rolling in like a field of daisies. Like, just makes, you know, like, that is what feels very French to me.
Well, the other thing that seems super French about this is in French poetics, there's the phrase that they have, which is le mot juste, meaning the right word, finding exactly the proper turn of phrase. And apparently, when he wrote this, he wrote several drafts all by hand, and each one was shorter than the last one, and he mercilessly cut out sections. And that move towards compactness and that move towards what is elided and suggested and towards increasing ambiguity of words seems to me, again, very much what you expect from French poetics. It's they seem to revel in the idea that words mean several different things at once. And the more meanings a sentence could have and the more ways it could be taken by mistake, the better. So I think this is a great book as a first French book to be introduced to French culture.
Yeah. And I think there's a convergence of two things here as well. So there's that which you just described, and also the author is a very serious literary writer, and literary writers are taught to sort of not spell things out for the reader. You want the reader to figure things out on their own and put a little bit of their own interpretation into it. So I think there's a lot of that going on as well. So I think you kind of have like the convergence of those two things. And then the end result is this, where like you'll get a sentence and you're like, that could mean so many things. And it's definitely by design.
Okay, so next we're introduced to the character, by way of extended flashback, to the character of the rose on the prince's little asteroid B612. One day, one of the plants that pops up turns out not to be a baobab, but turns out to be a rose, which is a hitherto unknown flower on the prince's planet. And this rose also can talk to the prince and has a very strong personality, a very coquettish personality. The rose is gendered. We're sort of supposed to read this as a kind of a proto-romantic relationship between the prince and the rose. I want to know what you think about the character of the rose.
I really liked it. If you want to come at it from like a 21st century feminist perspective, it's like, oh, well, she's kind of frivolous and very vain and kind of silly. But I think having her personality be that way was a great foil for the commentary on romance that is then threaded throughout the rest of the book. Because she is kind of silly. She's like fishing for compliments. And then when she doesn't actually know how she ended up on this planet, she just like, you know, coughs into her leaf, I guess. So that the prince, you know, is kind of put off guard. And then she goes back to fishing for compliments and asking for things and being demanding. And then the fact that she's so difficult gets you to the point, the realization that the little prince has, where it's like, you know, I should have seen through all of her fussing and the fact that she spread her fragrance throughout the entire planet, that really, she really loved me. And I should have been able to see that and appreciate that love, despite the flaws in her personality. So I think the flaws had to be there.
The prince eventually feels compelled to leave his planetoid because of the difficult, strained relationship with his rose. And as a child, I remember this taking place over the course of several chapters. As an adult, I'm amazed at how compressed that is. It's sort of, he's hardly given any motivation at all for leaving his planet, other than, I mean, that he just apparently can't understand the rose he's with and feels he needs his space. Did you find that kind of abrupt? I think you, as a first-time reader.
Yeah, I did, but the book has so much whimsy that I didn't mind it. It was like, okay, just accept it and move on.
Right. He flies off by catching a flock of wild birds that are passing by the asteroid. I always thought when I was older and I read this book first, and then I, a few years later, read James the Giant Peach, and I always thought that Roald Dahl must have stolen the idea of the birds flying off with the peach from this, but it may just be the illustrations looked very similar.
Mm, yeah.
And so now we go into a series of discussions of little planetoids that he visits one after another. He visits the next six tiny asteroids, and on each one he finds a single inhabitant who sort of stands for some aspect of adult life.
Mm-hmm. There's the king.
The king. Yeah. The king is first. I felt as a child that I needed to pay very close attention to this, because I kind of got that Saint-Exupéry was on about trying to teach something here, or trying to develop a theme here. And I thought that each of these characters was going to represent, you know, some great flaw of humanity or something or other. As an adult, I find them kind of oddly unparalleled in a way. You know, they're just kind of like little vignettes, and it could have been these six, or it could have been six other ones, you know. Do you know what I'm talking about here? I don't.
Yeah, but I liked it. I mean, it was like an extreme example. It was kind of like taking a flaw that in some capacity any adult could have or may have, and then just kind of crystallizing just that flaw into a sort of one-dimensional character that only has like one motive and one goal, as a way of kind of like focusing on what that flaw is. So it's kind of like if you took the six flaws that one person that could be cohabitating in one person, and you like slice and diced it and then just looked at each one.
Right. Now the king, I suppose his flaw is that he seeks obedience from his subjects, but on the other hand, he's so kind-hearted and so reasonable. He understands that you can't request that people do things that they can't do, and he kind of extends that into saying you can't really request things from people that they aren't predisposed to have done anyway. It becomes kind of more and more ridiculous because he asks the prince to do things that he can't do. What was the first thing he asked for him to do was
Was before the Minister of Justice bit. I'm trying to look through and find it. I know he leaves as an ambassador, which made me laugh. He has to judge himself. No, it's before that.
Right. Oh well, but the thing was, the prince also asks the king, because the king claims to be the ruler over the stars, to command a sunset. And this is where the king gets into this kind of mincing of words, where he says, you can't ask your subjects to do what they won't do. And again, it devolves into this kind of a satire on the ineffectualness of government in a way. Mm. But I'm not, you know, it seems less pointed to me now as I'm an adult. I don't dislike it. I find it very droll and very roundabout and very sly. I just don't see it moving to a hole the way I did when I was a child.
Yeah, and it's sort of like when people refuse to, like when they're very prideful, so then if they make a mistake or if there's an error, they spin it into, well, I meant to do that. It's, you know, like it has like a little bit of that, like I'm perfect, and when something isn't perfect, I'm just going to make it fit. Like, well, okay, then I guess you're the ambassador. Okay, I guess you're the Minister of Justice. But as long as the king doesn't lose his position where he feels superior to everything, right? So I like that aspect as well. It's sort of like that, I meant to do that. Or of course, I saw that as well.
Right. Yeah. Well, the prince has little patience for the king, yeah, and he flies off as the king makes him an ambassador on his way out the door. And on the next asteroid, he meets a conceited man. And this seems like an idea that didn't quite gel for me when I read this one. I was a little less, because the conceited man simply wants the prince to admire him. And once the prince admires him, the prince doesn't see what the value of that is and moves on. It seems in some ways a kind of a watered down version of The King to me.
Yeah, a little bit. This guy's just constantly looking for praise. I kind of liked it as well. Like, I just sort of like, yeah, I because they were so short, it didn't bother me. I think that's the benefit of having written it this way. Like, when you're writing things this short and this cleanly, you can kind of go off on little tangents and explore whatever little flaw you want, and the reader has a lot of patience for it.
I would be curious to know whether or not the original manuscripts had many more of these little vignettes, because it seems to me like he could have tried this or that or the other thing and then kind of picked the ones that he liked the best and put them in. That's the kind of writing that it is.
I mean, probably he's probably cut so much just because he was that kind of writer, as we both read.
The third planet has a what is translated to as a tippler in the translation that we're reading, but you know, an alcoholic. It's a kind of a sad and short chapter about that doesn't really. One of the things that struck me as I read it now is it seems a little. I'm not going to say unkind, but a little unknowing about
addiction.
Addiction. Yeah. Yes, exactly. It seems to me like the kind of jokes people made about drunks when we were growing up. You know, when I was growing up, I don't know if you know the movie Arthur with Dudley Moore, which was about a very rich guy who was an alcoholic, and it was supposed to be very funny that he had this, that he was drunk in every scene. And it's just kind of that kind of broadly played for sort of sardonic humor.
But this was my least favorite for the same reason. It kind of lacked compassion and understanding. Like, it's making fun of him because he's like, he drinks because he's ashamed because he drinks, so he drinks. So it has that circular thing, but there's external reasons why this is happening, and they're just sort of dismissed. It's like, well you're a failure, and they move on, which it just felt a little cold.
And part of that's the problem with this device of going to each asteroid in turn, where there's a single occupant, because what is ridiculous about each character in turn is the fact that they continue to carry out what would be a role or a social duty in the absence of a society to require that duty or to require that role. And in the case of the alcoholic, the question, you know, I think we would have from the 21st century is what caused this, what brought him to this. And if he's on a planet all by himself, it puts the onus squarely on him. And in the next, so the ridiculousness of the king is that he's a king, but he has no kingdom per se. And the conceited man wants to be admired, but there's no context in which he's admired. And in the next chapter, he meets a businessman on a planetoid who is engaged in counting all the stars. Now, this is the one I think I found the most amusing. I think it just has some of the best lines in it, when he talks about when the businessman calls the stars the millions of those little objects which one sometimes sees in the sky.
Yeah.
The businessman is very pleased to believe that since he thought of owning the stars before anyone else did, he now owns them all. And ownership for him consists of counting them and putting them into a drawer.
And I love that line about how he says that because he saw the stars first, or he claimed them first, then they're his. I really like that line as well, about that sort of mentality of, you know, the same thing like when they landed on the New World. We landed here first. It's now ours. Anything you discover is yours.
And I think that it's also a really good encapsulation of the overarching criticism that of adult life that runs throughout this book, which is that although the adults in the book continue to talk about being interested in matters of consequence, they are abstracted from life. This is obviously a ridiculous parody of business practices, but the idea that what you're after is an abstraction of ownership in the form of a number in paper that's locked up somewhere. Mm-hmm. I think it's obvious, but it's very well done. It's very clever.
I was just going to add that line where he says, where he talks about the ownership of the stars. Then the little prince says, "And what do you do with them?" "I administer them," replied the businessman. I love that line. Okay.
In the next one, he meets a lamplighter. It's a very tiny planet, we're told, the smallest planet of them all. And there is a single lamplighter lighting a single gas lamp. And this, as a child, struck me as the most strangely surreal chapter in the whole book. Now that I'm an adult, I see that the whole thing has been kind of odd and surreal throughout. But this caused an enormous amount of anxiety for me because of that very sense of isolation and why anyone would continue to light a lamp on a planet that was spinning around at this speed and needed to be lit and unlit at the rate that it did for the benefit of nobody. Now, as an adult, I'm much more used to this kind of surreal humor, but as a child, it was very worrying.
Yeah. And this one was a little sad too. I think this one, as well as with the Tippler, I think maybe part of the reason why the Tippler and the Lamplighter one were the ones that sort of seemed the least compassionate to me is because the humor is kind of punching down at somebody who isn't in a position of power, whether because they're an addict or because in this case, it's taking a snapshot of like the laborer, the person who's, you know, worked to the bone, who just wants to rest, who can't rest for whatever reason. I mean, here, yes, it's for nobody else, but every planet has that, right? It's just the idea that this is what they do. This is their role as an adult. And they are kind of in some kind of like mental prison in a way, whether it's because of alcohol or because of this kind of grueling labor. So this one also seemed like it lacked a little bit of compassion in the same way as that other one. I don't know how it felt to you.
Yeah, it does lack a bit of compassion. And it also, because it ends on sort of a down note, the prince suggests that the lamplighter might avoid having to light the lamp if he would just keep walking around the planet. And the lamplighter says all he wants to do is sleep anyway. It sort of ends in this trap that the lamplighter is in a kind of an oddly existential way. I mean, in some ways, that's the other thing I would say is, as an adult reading this through, I'm seeing it much more through the lens of existentialism. It obviously must have been out there in the air in some way. Mm-hmm. And then he comes to a planet with a geographer who is very happy that the prince has come along because the geographer never gets up from his desk. And so he's able to, for the first time, write down in a book some geographical features. Mm. And this is the chapter in which I learned the word ephemeral as a child. Because the geographer refuses to make a note of the rose because he points out to the prince that the rose is ephemeral, in danger of being exterminated. I also see this as a kind of a big setup for the next chapter. I don't know, something about this marks a kind of a shift in tone to me to the prince arriving on Earth, and I'm not exactly sure why. I just feel it, or maybe it's just because I remember that this is where it happens.
Right, because the geographer tells him to go to Earth.
Oh, yeah. Right. Well, there, that's probably it.
Tells him to go, so yeah. Yeah, and I think this one, it's poking less at a flaw than the other ones. Like, what's this guy's flaw that he doesn't get out of his desk and go on adventures? I think as an adult, you're like, that's fine. That's an absolutely fine thing to do with your life. Yeah, so it feels less critical.
And the geographer, if we've seen examples of royalty, of working class people, of the bourgeoisie, this is kind of an example of an academic. Mm-hmm. And I think that perhaps that de Saint-Exupéry is a little less critical of academics.
Yeah, that would make sense. Yeah.
So the prince does come to Earth, but not knowing much about Earth, he lands, he touches down in the middle of the desert. There's some clever little setup. So there's a chapter in here where he talks about the narrator talks about the number of geographers and businessmen and tipplers and conceited men that are on this planet. Mm-hmm. And he talks about the lamplighters lighting the lamps around the world. And then he says in the next chapter, there's a line here that I remember puzzling over as a kid because I didn't get, was when he says, when one wishes to play the wit, he sometimes wanders a little from the truth. He's basically saying, I was pulling your leg to make a joke in that last chapter. Mm-hmm. And I just did not understand this sentence at all as a kid. And then I remember puzzling over it in the French. There's a lot of these kinds of asides that are designed, I think, more for the adult readers of the book. And I'm not sure, even now, having read it as just now for this podcast, I'm not exactly sure for whom this book is being written.
No.
or other than maybe to amuse the author himself.
It's funny, whenever, for me, the book that I always think of when I think of books that talk to you, that it's in the second person and it's as if you're with somebody there, they're having a conversation with you. The first book that I noticed that was in The Hobbit. So it keeps making me think a little bit of The Hobbit. It's a completely different book, completely different style. But that idea where it's like, I'm telling you the story, and now I'm talking to you, the reader. And it sort of just made me believe the narrator a little bit more, was pretty much the only thing that it did. But as far as who it's written for, I have no idea. Yeah.
That's a really good parallel you make there, though, because I think about Tolkien, and in The Hobbit, and also in the first book of The Lord of the Rings, there are points where the narrator suddenly just fancifully goes off on some sort of a strange tangent, and you don't know whether or not you're supposed to be taking what he's saying seriously or not. Mm-hmm. In The Hobbit, the narrator suddenly talks about a battle in which a goblin's head gets rolled into a hole, and so the game of golf is invented. And I remember as a kid thinking, wait, did the narrator just tell me this? Is this like, and that kind of blew my mind, the idea that that this narrator, who up to that point I kind of trusted as an impartial voice, was suddenly going to make a joke.
Yeah.
Obviously, when you get older, you read a lot of Dickens or you read Jane Austen or something like that, where the narrative voice is so much a character.
Yeah, and you see it a lot in plays where the narrator who's standing downstage, who's talking to the audience, is also a character who's on the stage. When you're reading, you just have to be very aware of when is the narrator a character on the stage and when is the narrator looking at the audience, breaking the fourth wall, talking to you. So this line would be an example of that, right?
The prince lands in the Sahara Desert because he doesn't know any better where he should be landing on Earth, and he's surprised to find no people around, but he does run into a snake. And this is this foreshadowing towards the end of the book, where the snake talks about how lonely the prince must be, and how if he ever needs the snake's help, the snake will be able to send him back where he came. There's a kind of an interesting conceit here, which is that if dying on Earth means you return to Earth, the snake says, being from a star, when you die, you will return to the star.
But then the logical part of my adult brain's like, so he was dead before and now he's come back and now he's going to die again? Like that. The order of operations is confusing, but you just have to say it's fine. It's whimsical. Yeah.
This prince speaks briefly to a flower who says that there are not really any, there are only about a dozen men in existence because they get blown about by the winds. Mm-hmm. He climbs to the top of a mountain and talks to his own echo. And then he comes to a garden, a walled garden that is filled with roses. And he is astonished to find that his rose is not unique. And this causes him great distress and causes him to start sobbing. It reminds me, when I was a child, the first time I ever met someone who was also named John, I was very offended by this idea. How little I knew that John is probably the most common English name.
I mean, John Doe is the fill-in for... Yeah. I didn't have that problem with the name like mine, Anaïs, very rarely. Yeah.
And now we get the character of the fox, my favorite character in the book. And if you ever see the very strange live action movie of The Little Prince that was made, I think in like 71 or 72, the fox is played by Gene Wilder. And it's just very, very. Are you aware of this?
No,
this,
I need to this see film? This now because Gene Wilder as a fox.
Oh, it's an amazing film, and part of the thing that makes it amazing is the way they play it. Is Gene Wilder? He isn't dressed up like a fox. They have a fox appear, and then it turns into Gene Wilder, the human character, just standing there. And it works better than you might think it would. Because Gene Wilder is some kind of crazy lunatic. This was like peak Gene Wilder around the time of Willy Wonka and the Chocolate Factory.
Wow. All right, I need to see this now because that's amusing. Yeah. Apparently when the author was crashed in the Sahara, he saw a fennec fox. So there's just a lot of stuff that just comes into this from his real life.
The fox asks the prince to tame him because the fox says that his life is monotonous. It just consists of either hunting for chickens or being hunted by hunters. And he needs something to make his life, give his life color and meaning. It's very charming because he talks very knowingly about what has to happen in what order. He calls them rites that need to be observed that will cause the fox to be tamed.
Yeah. And there's parallels there to sort of like dating, courting rites.
Right.
Which are really nice, especially when a little bit later, we'll get there. But the comment on taming and how it feels when you're tamed or to tame someone. And then when the person who tamed you leaves and how that hurts has a nice parallel to sort of like the romantic commentary in the story. It's predominantly with the rose, but you see it a little bit as well with the fox.
Now, the French word that is used here, apprivoiser, which is an interesting word because it doesn't simply mean to domesticate. It is also used in French to mean to make someone sociable or to make them agreeable. So it's one of those things where, again, the meanings all get mixed up together. And it's a little bit, I think, richer in French than it is in English.
This story, the book overall, does a lot of mirroring. So a lot of the lessons that you see in the first half of the book come again later in the second half of the book. So in the first half of the book, we're seeing this taming. And this lesson of taming, it doesn't finish here. It's not until later when the narrator is sort of acknowledging that in a way he was tamed by the little prince as well. And how much it hurts then when the little prince leaves later, sort of finishes that lesson. So this, I think this was one of my favorite sort of foreshadowings in a way.
The other thing that struck me as very interesting here is the fox makes this claim about how the importance of taming, of developing these connections is the way that they create a metaphorical life, because he says that once you mean something to me, now I will associate you with the wheat where the wheat previously had no associations. It strikes me when I was reading this through that this is kind of an interesting lesson to take in light of, say, Buddhism, which the Buddhist outlook on life is that you need to detach, because detachment is going to cause you suffering and pain. And only when you detach can you actually be compassionate to the world. When you want nothing from something, then you're able to truly love. But this kind of takes a different point of view, which is you have to become passionately engaged with something. And it's sort of up to you to find what that something is. The fox admits that the rose is just one rose out of millions of roses in the world, but because of the act of taming, because of the act of giving his time to the rose, now meaning has been created. I find that kind of interesting because it seems to me like a very it seems to me like a very Western idea in a way.
Yeah, and I like how it applies not just to relationships, but to any sort of art, for example, the novel that you've been working on for so many years becomes precious to you because of all the time that you spent on it, or even something more trivial like a stamp collector. That collection's very, you know, important to them, partially because of all the time and effort that they've invested into it. So in a way, it's not just about relationships, but it's also just about how we as humans inject value into things through our own actions and our own time.
And in that way, it also strikes me as very existentialist, mm-hmm. because the existentialists say in a universe devoid of any meaning that comes from an external source, such as God, it's up to you to make your own meaning. And that act of making meaning in your life is an heroic one because it's an act of will. As I read this book, part of what I kept kind of puzzling over in my head is the prince certainly does not value the same things that the grown-ups value. And so there is a sort of he does have a normative view of the world in as much as he doesn't value the same things. But on the other hand, the book argues that it's kind of up to you to create your own meaning and relationships in the world. I don't know. I'm probably being too adult about this.
No, I know what you mean. Yeah. So it's sort of like the things that the prince invested in and the things that he values are the correct things to be invested in and value, as opposed to the adults who are valuing administrating stars tucked away in a drawer. Yeah. So he is, you know, very judgmental about it. But I feel like there is a little bit of what's the word for when you value things just because it's natural, because it's not synthetic? The idea that, like, you are wiser if you appreciate the mountain instead of appreciating, you know, I don't know, like a car. There's a word for that, but it's a kind of heuristic. So I think this is playing on that, and it kind of makes sense when you think of the author, who is an explorer type. He's an aviator. He likes to travel. That it would be somebody who is very much into nature and sees the natural world as being somehow more divine. The story doesn't really touch on the divine explicitly, but the fact that that the prince, you know, he talks about how, well, the stars have meaning for him more so than for the businessman, because for him, the stars remind him of the rose, reminds him of like a great love. So you still have this. So if you kind of merge love with divinity, then yes, the natural world and appreciating that makes you somehow spiritually better. If you agree with that, then this is perfect. Then you love this. And if you disagree with that, I think you can still take part of what the little prince is saying and sort of apply it to yourself in a balanced way, going back to like the Buddhism. Like there's a part of me that's like, he's not wrong, even if I don't completely agree with him.
There are two short chapters in here that puzzled me, because I didn't actually even remember them being in here, where the prince meets a railway switchman and the prince meets a merchant. I saw on Wikipedia that the original manuscript of The Little Prince had a lot of the prince's travels on Earth that were in here, including apparently a passage where the little prince came to New York City, which I find astonishing because it seems so out of tone with the rest of the book. And these chapters don't seem to introduce anything new, but they're kind of odd because now there are more people and the prince is no longer just kind of tooling about in the desert. He meets other people. I guess it marks the passage of time, because we later learn that the prince has been on the earth for 1 year at the point that the narrator meets him.
Yeah. Yeah, it's funny. So I just read this and I completely forgot about the railway switchman and the merchant as well. And I just read it. They're very forgettable scenes, even though rereading it very quickly, they do have points, but it's points that's been made before. Adults chasing nothing, you know, right. Yeah, they work too much. They don't focus on what's important. It's kind of like the same lesson.
The narrator at this point is beside himself with fear, because he's close to death by dehydration. And the prince suggests that they go off in search of a well. And the narrator thinks this is absurd. Where are you going to find a well out here in the desert? But as we said before, at this point, what else are you going to do if you're sitting out in the desert with no way out? You might as well follow the prince off. And sure enough, the prince finds a well. He pulls it up, and they drink together. And the narrator presents this as sort of an epiphany. He talks about how drinking the water brings back his memories of being a child at a Christmas midnight mass. Mm-hmm. Again, we have this idea that when you find something and you value it, it creates these kind of metonymical connections in your head. That's part of the way that you recognize an important and valuable connection is in the metaphors it suggests.
Mm-hmm. And they all seem to tie back to what you valued most as a child in his case. So the narrator, when he drinks the water and he understands and it tastes so sweet, he thinks back to his childhood. Right? It's not to right. some woman he loved as an adult or something like that.
The narrator also picks up that the prince is, that in spite of the fact that they have just been rescued from certain death, the narrator picks up that the prince is not happy and, in fact, very nervous. And he starts to ask, why did you come back here? Why did you come to the middle of the desert? And the narrator starts to suspect that the prince has some plan afoot. And in the next chapter, he overhears the prince talking to the snake.
This chapter jarred me the most because everything is so whimsical and nice, and all of a sudden it's like, here's the prince openly discussing suicide. Right? I mean, it's not in those terms. It's he wants to return back to his home planet and everything like that, but it just seems so dark out of nowhere when the story, even though it was somber, wasn't necessarily dark. And then all of a sudden it went in that direction and it really surprised me. And I think part of the reason why this also stayed with me is because the way that the author died was he disappeared in 1944. His plane disappeared. And there's a weird sort of parallel to the way that the little prince dies. Like the body just disappears and you join the stars again. And at the time, the author was suffering from depression. And I read somewhere that a few people have floated the theory that that he committed suicide, you know, through the plane by crashing it somewhere. It was found a long time later. There's been somebody who has since spoken up. I think it was a German pilot who said he believes he shot down the author by accident, but it's been disputed. There's a journalist who did a lot of work that says that it makes sense. The story could be true. He could have been shot down by accident by a German. But there's a lot of people who reject that, so it's still up for debate.
There's a recap here, I think, of these themes of how relationships are associative, because he talks again about if you love a flower that lives on a star, then all the stars are on any star, there could be your flower. Because of pulling the pulley, the sound of the pulley will be associated with music and bells for the narrator, and he will remember the prince's laugh. And so when the narrator looks at the stars, what he will hear is the sound of laughter.
All men have the stars, he answered, but they're not the same things for different people. For some who are travelers, the stars are guides. For others, they're no more than little lights in the sky. For others who are scholars, they are problems. For my businessmen, they were wealth. But all these stars are silent. You alone will have the stars as no one else has them. What are you trying to say? In one of the stars, I shall be living. In one of them, I shall be laughing. And so it will be as if all the stars were laughing. When you look at the sky at night, you, only you, will have stars that can laugh.
It's a kind of a beautiful conceit here, because the prince says that for both he and the narrator, there is a unique meaning to the stars. They have this connection to the stars, but it's still each viewer has his own associations.
But the narrator also pushes back a little bit on that, saying, but if on that planet, the flower, the thing that the little prince loved the most in the whole world or universe gets eaten or destroyed, then all of a sudden the stars for me no longer bring me joy, right? It's almost kind of like right. instead of like Schrodinger's cat, like, is it alive or dead? It's like with now with the flower, like, do the stars represent a living or dead flower? Yeah, which I thought was really nice as well. Really depressing too, that he can't just end on the happy note. He's entertaining both of these things. Yeah.
Well, we are at the end. The prince does walk off alone to be bitten by the snake. And this is where de Saint-Exupéry's compression really shows, because the narrative voice of the book itself kind of turns away at the point that the prince dies. You know, like, it can't even take looking at that, the prince dying. And then when the narrator comes back to the spot, the prince's body is gone. So that elision is there in the very text itself. And as you mentioned, the narrator becomes very fretful because he realizes that the picture of a sheep has been sent with a picture of a muzzle that has no strap, and so he's concerned about the flower. There's another incredibly charming thing, though, to me at the end, is he shows, and this is where one wishes on a podcast you could show the actual pictures, he shows the scene of the landscape with the star above it, which is supposed to be asteroid B612, and it's simply two lines that represent sand dunes and a single star, and he tells the reader to look for this landscape to see if the reader can find the little prince coming back again. It's so beautifully absurd. It's sad, but it's also funny. And that, I guess that's another thing I associate with the French, is the way that they like to mix their happiness and their sadness.
Yeah. Yeah. That drawing stood out for me as well, even though it's the simplest one. And when the little prince dies and he talks about how his body is what's going to disappear, but he'll live on in the stars, he's going to go, that he'll continue to live. Trust that. It's just the body. I've read somewhere that de Saint-Exupéry's brother, Francois, his dying words were, "Don't worry, I'm all right. I can't help it. It's my body." So when I read that, it's just like, oh, it twists right in the heart.
You're reading this book as an adult. What are your thoughts about this as a book for children? Do you think? I mean, I read it and I loved it. I'm not sure that I got too much out of it. Ironically, since the narrator insists that children can see inside things that adults can't, it's only as an adult that I feel like I'm picking up on all the nuance of the book.
Yeah, that's what was most surprising to me, is I expected the lessons and the morals to be childlike, like a parable, like something that's just like, okay, this is a universal truth. But they were so much deeper than that, that I felt it takes an adult experience to understand them.
I think you're absolutely right about that, because I think that the lessons that you learn from this aren't... Everyone has read moralistic stories for children in which a very simple lesson is taught about being honest or staying true to oneself. This is more a book about how to live your life and how to be in the world, and as a kind of an ongoing project.
Yeah, so when I think of like simplistic stories, so when I was really young, my great uncle gave me an illustrated copy of Aesop's Fables. And I feel like I didn't really miss much as a child, right? Like, they're very straightforward with Aesop's Fables, and they're very engaging. And plot-wise, those little fables are a lot more tense. They have bigger ups and downs. It's bigger obstacles. While this one, it's sort of so somber that I think as a child, had I read it, there's not enough plot happening to engage me. And I would have missed so much of the lessons that I feel like if I would have read it as a child, I might never have revisited as an adult, and then I would have missed out on a really great story.
We would be remiss if we weren't to mention that there's an animated version of this film that is, I'm not sure if it's in release yet or let me see here. It's going to be released eventually here in America. It had difficulty finding a distributor in America, I don't know whether it will be a good film or a bad film, but it from the trailer, it seems as though they have wrapped the entire story of the Little Prince with yet another story, the story of a little girl who hears the story of the Little Prince from the aviator when he is old. And I gather that this new character, this little girl, will also take part in the story in some way. And I'm willing to give it all a chance. You know, I want there to be more female characters, and this book has, you know, exactly one female character. It's nice to introduce a female character. I just don't like the idea of another wrapper around this which already seems to have a wrapping story.
Yeah, I'd be curious to see what they're going to do with that character, because as you described it right now, it just seems like a framing device to kind of check that box. But what are they adding to the story by doing that? Like I said, since I didn't read this as a child, I don't have any sort of precious feelings about, you know, the sanctity of the story. Like, I read it, you know, in the past like couple of weeks. But even then, when you described that, I kind of rejected it. Like, it just seems like this, it's kind of perfect as it is. Like, you don't need to keep touching it, because it's like the things that it's doing well. And I think it's almost, it's one of those things where it's like, if you're looking at diversity, you might be frustrated that it's yet again another little, you know, boy who happens to be white as well, everything like that. But it just is. I'd almost want someone to just write something inspired by this with a more diverse character, rather than taking the same story and just like wrapping it in diversity.
The ending of this book is such a model of ambiguity. The important thing about the end of the story is not knowing. You know, we did earlier on this podcast, we did the Lady or the Tiger, which when it's taught in high school, I think a lot of time gets wasted by teachers asking students to come up with, what do you think it was? Do you think it was the lady or the tiger? And I always feel it's quite obvious that the story is not about that, that the story is about living with ambiguity or embracing that and enjoying that for what it is. And so I think the ending on this note of anxiety about the fate of the rose is so crucial to the way that the story goes. I don't know. I just worry that they are going to try to I just worry that they will try to give some sort of an uplifting ending to the story, and I think that would be a shame.
Yeah, I mean, I think that's what some of the criticisms of the Richard Howard translation are, that it's like it's a little bit sunnier when it shouldn't be sunny. Like, leave it bleak, leave it French. Although I do think maybe some of the criticisms of the translation might be from people who read it as a child and are feeling very precious about the version that they read. But I trusted the essays that I read on Amazon arguing for the Catherine Woods translation, and then I dug it up for that reason, and I loved it, so.
Thanks again to co-host Anaïs Concepcion. You can listen to her podcast, Literary Roadhouse, at literaryroadhouse.com. Thanks to Zach Powers for the reading. His podcast, Stage of Fools, has just wrapped up its second season. You can find it on iTunes. Thanks as always to Malcolm Nygaard for the theme music. Look for him at epochgraffiti.com. If you like discussing books or high school or books in high school, join us on the Facebook Sophomore Lit page. You can also write me at sophomore.literature@gmail.com. Sophomore Lit is brought to you by the Incomparable Network. For more funny, smart podcasts, visit incomparable.com. And as always, everything will be on the final.